No doubt about it. Democrats have been doing a lot of soul-searching since the November 2nd election, what with George W. Bush winning re-election and Republicans increasing their majorities in both houses of Congress. Some Democrats have come up with some ideas on what they'd like to see change. Some of them say that Democratic candidates from now on should use more religious language and symbolism to appeal to church-going voters. Others are suggesting that perhaps the party should moderate its position on some of those hot-button social issues, things like abortion. Thomas Frank has a different theory. He says Democrats need to focus on the economy. In his influential book, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America, Thomas Frank argued this year that Republicans have redefined social class as a cultural rather than an economic phenomenon. And he says that by turning class warfare into a cultural war, Republicans have laid claim to one of the Democrats' most powerful political weapons, namely populism. Thomas Frank says that if Democrats want to start winning elections again, they need to forcefully advocate for policies that soften the sharp edges of the free market and redistribute some of America's abundant wealth. Thomas Frank was in the Twin Cities earlier this month to accept the St. Paul-based Jobs Now Coalition's annual Working Class Hero Award. Jobs Now is a nonprofit activist organization that tries to help people find jobs that pay what's called a living wage. Anyway, here's author Thomas Frank speaking earlier this month at the coalition's annual meeting.
It's awfully nice of you guys to have me here. And it's, to be a working class hero, you know, I've come a long way from my youth in the super affluent suburb of Mission Hills, Kansas, to receive this award. It's a suburb of Kansas City that's anything but working class. But when I was born, my family did live in more working class part of town and moved over to Mission Hills, this sort of affluent land in the 1970s. And I've been thinking about this a lot today as we drove around this city, because this is the home of, or St. Paul anyway, is the home of one of my favorite authors of them all, F. Scott Fitzgerald, who had a kind of a similar upbringing to me, that grew up around these people, you know, the people that own the world that we live in. Didn't he grow up right down the street from James J. Hill or something like that? And was fascinated by them, and even deceived himself and believed that he was one of them. And they schooled them, didn't they? But he came back and wrote some of the greatest books about the way those people live and the way they think, and analyzed their society in a way that's impossible for a nonfiction writer like me to do. The neighborhood that I grew up in was where the Kansas City elite lived. My neighborhood went for Barry Goldwater by 70%. In 1964, and that's rare even in Kansas. Even Kansas didn't go for Barry Goldwater that year. A lot of the kids that I played with when I was little, their dads were in jail for white-collar crimes. It's a common thing. It turns out that's common there. Relatively unknown fact. And as I said, I believed I was one of them, because I played with these kids and that sort of thing. Of course, my dad was always, a stand-up guy and would never went to jail or anything like that. And they let me know that I wasn't one of them eventually. And now here I am, a working-class hero, which is such a great honor. But anyhow, sometimes I look out at the world around us, and I think that we are headed back to Scott Fitzgerald's world, where the rich really are different than the rest of us. And so I want to get started on tonight's subject of social class, but I want to start by going over some fairly dry statistics. Now, we Americans, as everybody here in the room knows, like to think of ourselves as a classless society, but as we all also know, this isn't true, either in terms of facts or, more importantly, in terms of our dominant ideology. We have profound class differences in America, as we all know, and we have a uniquely American way of talking about them, too. Now, for years, as everybody in this room knows, the class divide in this country has been getting worse, and it gets worse in good times, and it gets worse in hard times. Back in 1980, when the great conservative revolution was just getting going. Over 20% of the American workforce belonged to a private sector workforce, belonged to a labor union, and American CEOs were paid on average about 42 times what their average blue-collar line worker received. And that was a number that was pretty comparable with the figures that you saw coming out of Western Europe and Japan at the time. By the end of the 1990s, CEOs took home CEOs took home 500 times as much as their average line workers did, while unions have fallen to around 8% of the private sector workforce, which is almost what it was back in Scott Fitzgerald's heyday. Back in 1980, you still used to hear these comforting descriptions of America as an affluent society. Remember that phrase? Beautiful phrase. It was supposed to be a middle-class country where we had this rough equality of condition in addition to the usual, you know, ways that we define equality, equality before the laws, that kind of thing. Around that time, I think it was in 82 or 83, the literary critic Paul Fussell wrote a book, a really mean book, about social class, in which the basic conceit was this idea that you could have a blue-collar person living next door to a white-collar person, that they'd make virtually the same amount of money, and that all that would distinguish them were their tastes and their consumer choices. And then Fussell went on to mock viciously their tastes and consumer choices. Anyhow, it would be impossible to write a book like that today. The gulf between the two classes nowadays is just too vast. I mean, the notion of workers living in the same neighborhood or next door to executives strikes us as, you know, fundamentally foreign today. That's something that happens in like Scandinavia or something like that. Today nobody talks about shared affluence or the affluent society as being this basic American characteristic. Instead, they tell us that it's our tolerance for and acceptance of great extremes of wealth and poverty that make us who we are, that make America unique among the nations of the world and so miraculously profitable. Now, what is true for American CEOs is also true for the social class to which they belong. Back in 1979, the richest stratum of our society owned about 20% of the nation's wealth. Today, they got 40%. Measured according to what the economists call the Gini Index, and I'm not even going to try to explain how they figure this out, but if you can chart inequality in a society, you know, with a graph. And today the U.S. has achieved levels of wealth inequality that are both unique among the industrialized nations and that we haven't seen here in the United States since the 1920s, about when the Site of Paradise was coming out. Now, accompanying all of this has been the intrusion of corporate power into more and more aspects of everyday life. As everybody in this room knows, average Americans work harder and for longer today than they have in previous decades. They see more ads on more surfaces than ever before in history. They take more personality tests and more drug tests at work. They've rung up ever greater household debts. They have less power than at any time during the previous 50 years over the conditions in which they live and work. The world of business, it sometimes seems, is becoming the world, period. Y'all remember the magazine Fast Company? Sort of the flower of new economy thought back in the 1990s. Here's how they described it. Corporations, they said, have become the dominant institution of our time, occupying the position of the church of the Middle Ages and the nation state of the last two centuries. And that's a pretty extravagant claim, and that is the story of social class in America in recent years. But to hear our media talk about the subject, you'd get quite a different impression. Oh, we're a nation divided, all right. We're at each other's throats here in the United States, but the real divide, they tell us, is between the Republican red states, you know, where dwell the humble, patriotic, God-fearing common people, and then the blue states, of course, like this one, where reside the wicked know-it-alls of the two coasts and then honorary members of the, you know, coastal society, because you're on Lake Superior and all that, right? blue staters who affect their French manners as they drive their Volvos around their degraded boutique latte towns. That's supposed to be social class in America. And as for the politics that go along with social class, well, as we all know, the elite blue state snobs are said to be the kind of people who put their trust in government, while the common folk of the Great Plains, the prairie populace who burn with such a righteous Limbavian fire, are said to trust the people. Which means, in the parlance of the day, that they trust the market. And the man that they elected, George W. Bush, heard the vox populi and saw that it was good and moved swiftly and surely to shower his corporate donors with favors of every kind, to roll back workplace safety and deregulate in every way, to privatize Social Security and crack down on those interfering labor unions. Because in America, when we talk about social class, that's just the way it is. That's just how we understand the terms. What the common people want is more power to General Electric, right? More power to Citibank. They want another crack at that dot-com bubble, damn it. They want to see that Dow Jones average hit 36,000. They want to pile up their money at the feet of Bill Gates or Larry Ellison or Sam Walton or whoever the hero CEO happens to be this year. And should it turn out that they don't want those things, if they go out there and protest or strike or produce studies like this one, or vote for the wrong fella, then our op-ed pages stand ready to call them elitists, despicable, self-absorbed snobs, who by their failure to believe in the goodness of market forces are helping to trample down the unfortunates of the third world. And 1,000 corporate PR departments stand ready to chime in to insist that business is just an altruistic operation dedicated to raising up the little people of the planet. Every time they bust a union in America, a worker somewhere cries out for joy. Now, this word elitist, this is critical to the way to what my book is about and to the way it's an analysis of conservative thought. And the word elitist is critical. They use it all the time. They throw it around constantly, the E word. And it is a way for them to think about class that basically winds up standing traditional notions of class on their head. And things are upside down today in America, believe you me. When the areas that are hardest hit by conservative economic policy are also areas that are most enthusiastic for conservative politicians, then something has gone badly awry. And when the poorest state in America, West Virginia, a place that I should point out is home to some pretty ferocious class consciousness, this is a state that even went for Michael Dukakis, but when this place goes for George W. Bush by 13 points, as it did a few weeks ago, there is something wrong. And when the two poorest counties in America, both of them just a little bit to the west of here, out on the Great Plains, go for Bush by 78% and 81% respectively, there is something deeply wrong. Now, it's not that people in these states and in these counties have suddenly become complacent and satisfied like the Republicans of old. On the contrary, they're mad as hell. They're red with rage. That's why they call them red states, you know. They're up in arms. They're caught up in a populist revolt that they believe is helping to bring down the haughty and the conceited. Now, if you earn over $300,000 a year, I want to suggest that you owe a great deal to this populist revolt. Raise a glass sometime to those indigent High Plains Republicans as you contemplate your good fortune. Because it's thanks to their self-denying votes that you are no longer burdened by the estate tax or by those meddling banking regulators. It's thanks to the allegiance of these sons and daughters of toil that you're able to buy two Rolexes this year instead of just one and take that tour of Indochina by sedan chair. That's what they're all doing. I read about it in one of those travel magazines, you know. Tour of Indochina by sedan chair. Or maybe you are one of those many, many millions. I mean, this is hypothetical, admittedly. I know we're in a blue state. I know I'm at the Jobs Now Coalition, but I'm going to say it anyway. Maybe, because I give this lecture to all sorts of different audiences, red states as well as blue. And maybe you are one of those many, many millions of average Americans that see nothing wrong about this picture at all. And for you, this image of hard times conservatism, well, that makes perfect sense to you, and it's the opposite phenomenon. Working class people who insist on voting for liberals, that's what strikes you as an indecipherable puzzlement. Maybe you see it the way a bumper sticker I once spotted in Kansas City puts it. A working person that supports Democrats is like a chicken that supports Colonel Sanders. Maybe you're one of those, again, admittedly hypothetical, maybe you're one of those who stood up for America way back in 1968, sick of hearing those rich kids in beads badmouth the country every night on TV. Maybe you knew exactly what Richard Nixon meant when he talked about the silent majority, you know, the people whose hard work was rewarded with nothing but insults from the network news and the know-it-all college professors, none of them interested in anything you had to say. Maybe it was Ronald Reagan pulled you into the conservative swirl with that way he had of talking about that sunshiny Glenn Miller America you remembered from the time before the world went to hell. Or maybe you were pushed. Maybe it was Bill Clinton made a Republican out of you with his patently phony compassion and his obvious contempt for average non-Ivy League Americans. Now, this movement to the right that I am describing, I think is probably so familiar that I'm willing to bet that every single person in this room has some kind of conversion story that they can tell. How, say, their dad had been a union steel worker and a stalwart Democrat all his life, but how one day their brothers and sisters just started voting Republican. Or how their cousin gave up on Methodism and started going to the Pentecostal church out on the edge of town. Or how they themselves just got so sick and tired of being scolded all the time for eating meat or for wearing clothes emblazoned with Chief Alinawek that one day Fox News started to seem fair and balanced to them after all. Now, Chief Alinawek is the mascot of the University of Illinois. Nobody knows that here, but it's very funny in Chicago. They roar with laughter. You'll just have to take my word for it. It's one of those offensive Indian mascots. And every time there's a movement to replace him down at University of Illinois, I swear, Fox News is on the case immediately. And they're like, they're going after the chief again. And O'Reilly will have, you know, a special about it with, you know. Anyhow, every time it happens, they convert 10,000 more Republicans. Anyhow, each of these incidents is an expression of what I call in the book the Great Backlash. A style of conservatism that first came snarling onto the national stage in response to the partying and protests of the late 1960s. And while your earlier forms of conservatism used to emphasize fiscal sobriety, the backlash mobilizes voters with the explosive social issues, summoning up our outrage over everything from busing to blaspheming art, but which outrage it then marries to pro-business economic policy. And this is the key, okay? Cultural anger is marshaled to achieve economic ends. And it's the economic ends that are most important. It is the greatest monuments of the conservative movement. The backlash is what has made possible the great international free market consensus of recent years, with all the privatization and deregulation and deunionization that are its components. It's the backlash that ensures that Republicans, like our current president, will continue to be returned to office even when their free market miracles fail and their libertarian schemes don't pan out, and they never do, and their new economy collapses in ruins. It doesn't matter. The backlash ensures that they go back, that they get reelected, and the backlash is what makes possible the policy pushers' fantasies of globalization and a free trade empire that are then foisted on the rest of the world with such self-assurance. Now look, the culture war has made the laissez-faire revival possible. But this doesn't mean that backlash leaders speak to us in the manner of the capitalists of old, you know, invoking the divine right of money or demanding that the lowly learn their place in the great chain of being. They don't do that. On the contrary, the backlash tells us that it is a foe of the elite, that it is the voice of the unfairly persecuted, that it is a righteous protest of the people on history's receiving end, that its champions, in fact, today control all three branches of government, matters not a whit. That its greatest beneficiaries are, in fact, the wealthiest people on the planet, doesn't give it pause. In fact, backlash leaders systematically downplay the politics of economics. The movement's basic premise is that culture outweighs economics as a matter of public concern, that values matter most, as a book from about 10 years ago put it. And on these grounds, the backlash rallies citizens who would once have been reliable partisans of the New Deal to the standard of conservatism. Now, as we all know, once conservatives are in office, of course, the only old-fashioned situation they really care about reviving at all is the economic one of low wages and lax regulations. I mean, values don't matter a damn to George W. Bush and his cronies. They just want to, you know, they want to smash Social Security, smash the graduated income tax, reduce the tax burden on corporations and the wealthy and so on, return this country to a 19th century pattern of wealth distribution. That's what it's all about. And this is the primary contradiction of the backlash. It is a working class movement that has done incalculable, historic harm to working class people. Like a French Revolution in reverse, in which the sans-culottes come pouring down the streets screaming, "More power to the aristocracy!" You know. The backlash pushes the spectrum of the acceptable to the right and to the right and further to the right. And it'll never bring prayer back to the public schools, but it has managed to roll back many of the landmark economic reforms of the 1960s, many of those of the 1930s, and today its leaders are getting started on the earliest achievements of the progressive era of 100 years ago. With a little more effort, I think, the backlash may well repeal the entire 20th century. So, how are we supposed to make sense of all this? Okay? How is it that our angry conservatives can claim to hate elites, but somehow excuse from their fury the corporate world, even when it has, as we saw, so manifestly screwed them over? How do they do that? How do they join in an uprising of the common people that only winds up making the upper crust even crustier than ever? How do they decide that one guy, you know, John Kerry, yachtsman, is a Frenchified snob for being rich, but that the riches of another guy, and you know who I mean, George W. Bush, tough guy, you know, that his riches show him to be a regular fellow? How do they make that decision? How do they figure that out? Now, at the center of it all, I want to suggest, is a way of thinking about class that both encourages class hostility and at the same time denies the economic basis of the class grievance. Class, conservatives will tell you, is not really about money or birth or even occupation. It is primarily a matter of cultural authenticity. You know, that most valuable commodity. Class is about what kind of car you drive and where you shop and how you pray, and only secondarily about the job that you do or the income that you make. So what makes you a member of the noble proletariat is not work per se, but, you know, moral qualities, unpretentiousness, humility, and the rest of the sort of red state virtues that our punditry sort of never tires of celebrating. So the producer class, according to conservative mythology, the producer class doesn't care about unemployment or a dead-end life or a boss that earns 500 times as much as they do. No. Out in places like Kansas, both workers and their bosses are supposed to be united in righteous disgust at those affected college boys sitting over at the next table, prattling on about French cheese and villas in Tuscany and the big ideas for running things that they got from books. Okay? So those are the real parasites, not Enron, not Halliburton, not Merrill Lynch. It's you guys. It's me. That's who it is. That's the elite. Now, the key element in this repackaging of social class is the idea of a liberal elite. and you have heard this term before from infinite repetition on the Rush Limbaugh program, I'm certain. But it's not just Rush. This idea is everywhere, and it's been around for 30 years. But in its basic outlines, it has always remained pretty much the same. And it goes like this. Our culture and our schools and our government, backlashers will tell you, are controlled by an overeducated ruling class that is contemptuous of the beliefs and the folkways of average people. Those who run our country, the theory holds, are despicable, self-important show-offs. They are effete, to use one of Spiro Agnew's favorite terms. It's always bugged me. Spiro Agnew took that job over from Hubert Humphrey. That's like, that's awful. And that just, that's like, tells you volumes about what conservatism is and where it goes. I mean, comparing those two men. But Spiro really did have a way with words, didn't he? Remember the nattering nabobs of negativism? Hey, that's us! The impudent snobs. Hey, that's me! Anyhow, effete. That's us. We're always supposed to be arrogant. We're supposed to be snobs. We are, in a word, liberals. Now, conservatism, on the other hand, tells us that it is the doctrine of the oppressed majority. Unlike your classical 19th century conservatism, the backlash doesn't defend some established order of things. It accuses, you know, it rants, it points out hypocrisies and gleefully pounces on contradictions. And while liberals are always supposed to be using their power to control the airwaves and the newspapers and the schools and persecute average people, the Republicans tell us that they are the party of the disrespected, the downtrodden, the forgotten man. They're the party of dissent, always in rebellion against a haughty establishment, always rising up from below. That's the Republican Party. So all claims on the right, in other words, advance today from victimhood. And this is why backlashers, and that might sound a little strange, because as you know, if you watch their media at all, they're constantly berating, what they perceive to be thin-skinned minorities for imagining that they're victims. I was on a conservative radio show where his slogan was, "The victimhood stops here." And then, you know, we turn on the microphones and he starts complaining about how Christians, conservative Christians, are persecuted right here in the U.S. of A. This is this common mantra that they have, that they are the real persecuted party in America today. In fact, Rush Limbaugh's brother, David Limbaugh, has actually written a book with one of these, you know, one-word titles that conservatives love. And the title is Persecution. And you know what the message is, right? Conservative Christians, persecuted. Right here, right now. There's religious persecution going on all around us, and you're the ones doing it. If you read a lot of conservative listservs, which I did when I was writing this book, you'll read emails in which conservatives greet fellow conservatives with phrases like this one, "fellow rubes of the flyover." You know, they love to imagine how, they love to speculate about the many ways in which liberals are supposed to look down on them. And you know, there's a book that came out, a conservative book that came out about a year ago, and I saw an advertisement for it. And this is an advertisement trying to promote this book, trying to advance its sales. And this is the ad. Here's the headline. "Are you stupid?" And then, you know, below that it says, "The elites think so." And you pick up the book, and sure enough, every chapter is like, these elites say these mean things about conservatives, and these other elites say these other mean things about... They love to talk about this. I mean, a total persecution fantasy that they have. You know, the American Enterprise Institute, the people that gave you the war in Iraq, before they started that war, before they dreamed that baby up, they were running a bunch of articles about the virtues of the red states as opposed to the blue states. One of those articles about the virtues of red land begins with this sentence: "I'm stupid, and if you're reading this, you probably are too." Another thing conservatives love to do is boast of their own. I mean, it's kind of funny, isn't it? They really are stupid. I mean, those guys. Another thing conservatives love to do is boast of their own by saying that, I'm referring to the Iraq War, by the way, just so you know. I think a lot of these guys really are salt of the earth good people, but the Iraq War is just, that's flat out stupid. But they love to also boast of their own subversiveness. And this might sound a little strange, but think about it. They love this phrase, politically incorrect. They love to imagine how they're always tweaking the establishment. John Leo, who's a columnist for U.S. News and World Report, wrote a book in 1994 that he called Two Steps Ahead of the Thought Police, right? Because you people were out to get poor John Leo. In 2001, he wrote another book that he called Incorrect Thoughts. And I particularly liked this one because, as it turns out, that's also the title of a 1981 album by the leftist hardcore punk rock band, The Subhumans. You remember them? Now, the object of all this breast-beating underdoggery is not to un-victimize the average Americans for whom conservatism claims to speak. Indeed, that is ruled out almost from the get-go. While most of us think of politics as a kind of, you know, Machiavellian drama in which actors make alliances and then take practical steps to advance their own fortunes, right? That's what politics is. But according to the backlash, politics is something very different. It is a moral crusade in which your material interests are suspended in favor of vague cultural grievances that are both all-important and yet incapable of ever being assuaged. And that last part is important, because as culture war, the backlash was born to lose. Its goal is not to win cultural battles, but just to take offense conspicuously, vocally, flamboyantly, getting mad. This is what the backlash is all about. Not changing anything, getting mad. Indignation is the sort of great aesthetic principle of backlash culture. I sometimes think, you know, if they take over the world like they might do, that's what my next book is going to be about. It's like the different shadings of indignation, a field guide to right-wing anger, something like that. I mean, everything seems to piss these people off. And they react not by getting unpissed off, but by documenting and cataloging their disgust, by generating these endless piles of petty, unrelated beefs with the world, you know, amassing thousands, and you can go on their websites and find this rhetorical style in action, these thousands and thousands of very short stories of the many, many tiny ways the world that surrounds us assaults family values, uses obscenities, disrespects parents, foments revolution, and on and on and on and on and on. And although this culture of offense-taking describes only the most superficial aspects of American life, the implication of it is that liberalism can be held responsible for the world around us. That each of these little objections to the way people drive, the way people cut in line, the way people chew, you know, talk with their mouths full, that each of these is somehow an indictment of the left. And it doesn't matter. In the conservative world, and you know what I'm talking about, and I'll give you examples after I'm done if you want to hear, but it doesn't matter in conservative land that liberals have long since lost their power over government. In the backlash mind, liberalism is still what changes our mores, what determines what's on TV and in the magazines, and what makes, or rather interprets, the laws. There is nothing that can protect us from liberalism. Not the Constitution, not our guns, not even sweeping electoral victories of the kind that they have enjoyed every 4 years since 1968. None of these things can protect us from liberalism or even slow it down. Liberalism is an alien, conspiratorial force that can't be held accountable and that doesn't care when its projects go awry. Now, let me remind you before we go on that this is a class-based complaint, or it's something very close to it. It's the, you know, it's class sort of stood on its head. It's the honest, hard-working people of middle America against a tiny, self-righteous band of snobs lording it over the rest of us with their fancy college degrees. So culture war is class war by other means. And insofar as they pretend to take on the liberal elite, Republicans are able to present themselves as the true leaders of the working class. And they actually do this. I'm not making it up. And they use the old language of the left when they do so. And here's an example. Gary Bauer. You know who this guy is? Ran for president in 2000 when he was the head of the Family Research Council. Today he runs something. It's like your alter ego. He runs something called the Campaign for Working Families. Hey, we might as well call it Jobs, what, Jobs Never. But the Campaign for Working Families. And the New York Times called Gary Bauer up and asked him to explain the enduring power of the culture wars. And here's what he said. And I think this is very profound. He said, Joe Sixpack doesn't understand why the world and his culture are changing and why he doesn't have a say in it. And you know what? That's something that my team used to say. That's something that liberals used to say. That's something that the left used to be able to say. We were the ones that stood up for the alienated and the powerless and the ones that didn't have a voice. How is a guy like Gary Bauer able to make a claim like that? I mean, speaking up for the alienated, that is the property of the left. How does he get away with just walking off with that? He's able to do it because in conservative movement culture, there is a systematic erasure of the economic. Okay, this is the maneuver that they make that makes everything else possible. Now, as everybody in this room knows, there's some species of conservative that are happy to talk economics with you, and you can find them any day of the week over at the University of Chicago Econ Department, or hell, here at the University of Minnesota. Or down the street, or whatever the hell it is, or at the Federal Reserve Bank, or in the business magazines of this country, prattling on about the mystical inerrancy of the free market and the benevolence of global capitalism. But conservatives, values conservatives, culture war conservatives, don't say much about the business world at all. For them, it's natural, it's normal, it's almost divine. They just don't talk about it. Now, the erasure of the economic is a necessary precondition for basically all of the backlash ideas that we've been discussing. For example, it's only possible to think that the news media is slanted to the left if you never take into account who owns the news media, and if you never, ever, ever turn your critical eye on something like CNBC or the Wall Street Journal or the business section of every newspaper in America. You just don't ever think about that. Erase it from your mind. The university campus can only be imagined as a place dominated by leftists if you never consider econ departments or business schools or the management strategies of the modern university. Most importantly, it's only possible to understand pop culture as the product of free-floating liberalism, which is what they think, if you have blinded yourself to the most fundamental of economic realities, namely that the networks, and the movie studios, and the ad agencies, and the publishing houses, and the record labels are, in fact, commercial enterprises. In some ways, I think, the backlash vision of life is nothing more than a very, very old-fashioned leftist vision of the world, but with the economics drained out. Where the muckrakers of old, and I mean of 100 years ago, used to always fault capitalism for botching this institution and that, the backlash thinkers simply changed the script to blame liberalism. So, an example. Up until the late 1960s, the standard critique of the press that you heard in the United States, and when I say standard, I mean everyone from Upton Sinclair to A.J. Liebling, the press columnist for The New Yorker, the critique that they would give you was that newspapers tilted to the right, serving the interests of the capitalists that advertised in them and the capitalists that owned them. Think of such sterling and warm-hearted characters as William Randolph Hearst and Colonel McCormick of the Chicago Tribune, you know, that great liberal. That's a joke. Colonel McCormick he hired a guy to be foreign correspondent, sent him over to Nazi Germany before the war. When the war started, the guy defected to the Nazis. That's how liberal they were. That's how liberal they were at the Chicago Tribune. But listen, today, as everybody knows, it is supposed to be liberal reporters and liberal editors. The publishers are out of the picture. It's always the reporters or the anchorman in the broadcast booth who are supposed to be twisting the news to match their elitist personal preferences. And the same treatment has been administered to old-fashioned critiques of higher education. Again, Upton, all the things that Upton Sinclair wrote about. Higher education, the legal establishment, the foundation world, the foreign policy establishment, architecture, and government itself, which with each of these institutions now said to be a servant not of the interests, but of liberalism. Even the rhetoric of the backlash, with all of its, you know, regular guy flourishes, sometimes appears to have been lifted whole cloth from the proletarian literature of the 1930s. Now, I know this because I will confess here, one of my hobbies is collecting this genre of literature called proletarian fiction, which was a very short-lived fad in the 1930s. And you can buy it on eBay by the pound. And I've got shelf after shelf of it. So I'm sitting there, you know, reading this stuff, you know, this kind of bad literature from the 30s, all this very heavy-handed workerist stuff. And I'm reading Ann Coulter at the same time. And by God, it is the same stuff. It's really weird. You think about it. The idea that average people are helpless pawns caught in a machine run by the elite basically comes straight out of your old vulgar Marxist copybook, you know, which taught generations of party members that they inhabited a deterministic world where agency was something reserved for capitalists only, or for capital itself, to be precise. And your old school proletarian writers love nothing more than to mock the Frenchified pretensions, you know, of the effete. They loved that word too, just like Spiro, devitalized upper classes. And they would always talk about them being able to speak French, them writing with, you know, purple ink, you know, being perfumed, drinking wine, all of this stuff. The today's backlash crowd, you know, David Brooks, Ann Coulter, Rush Limbaugh, the rest of them, they just turned the stereotype on liberals. That's all they've done. So now we get to the all-important question of how do those liberals respond? What do? Do they hammer home the economic realities and say, no, you can't erase this stuff? Do they remind the world of the true meaning of class? No, they don't do any of that. They walk right into the buzzsaw, year after year after year after year. They triangulate. And they accommodate, and they sign off on the entire Reagan economic agenda, and they prostrate themselves at the feet of Wall Street, you know, in order to prove that they are safe for corporate campaign contributions. They declare blue-collar workers to be a constituency of the benighted Depression-era past and turn their attention instead to cool, hip, new demographics that are farther up the economic ladder. They openly embrace hip, 90s-style management theory. They imagine, they fantasize about themselves as the Metro Party of cool billionaires against the retro Republican Party of square billionaires. And so that's what it was all about, right? Cool billionaires versus square billionaires. I mean, these guys, and you know who I'm talking about here, the centrist Democrats in D.C., they want to be the liberal elite. They want the right-wing hallucination to be real. It's true. So what do I suggest that we do instead? I think that we have to confront their fake populism, and this is so important to their movement, this fake populism. We have to confront that stuff with the real deal. We have to start talking one more time about the economic powers that really, honestly do make our lives what they are, and really, truly do so, like Gary Bauer says, without average people having any say in it. We have to talk about Walmart and how their business plan is the exact opposite of what Americans expect from the corporate world. You know, the idea that that you'll pay your workers enough so that someday they'll be able to afford your product. Today, the forces all push in the other direction, and we should be talking constantly about why that is. We should talk about, you know, what's happened to people who work and why. We should talk about Enron and how what they did was typical, not, you know, how it was systemic, not something strange, not just a few rotten apples in the barrel. We should talk about Wall Street and the way they operate, the way they get things done, and the way they have restructured our world. I mean, it's not the hand of God that has done this to us. And above all, we have to talk about free markets as though they weren't some force of nature that we have to bow before or else. And we have to talk about creating security from the whirling winds of the free market. Now, talking this way, I think, will accomplish five important things. And I'm not going to go very long here because you guys know all this already. But the reason you have to do this, the reason that we on the left have to bring this narrative back and start talking this way again, is because, first of all, we have to problematize their populist narrative, their ridiculous backlash narrative. We have to strip conservatives of this all-powerful E word. We can't let them talk about elitism anymore as though it was liberals, people who think they know better than the free market or something like that. And when you talk about the Republican Party's traditional role as the servant of the business community, and when you talk about Republican policy in terms of its corporate agenda, it will instantly cause their fantasy populism to crumble. And I sincerely believe that. Compared with the real deal, I think, their fake populism of shadowy, manipulative intellectuals, I think this will seem laughable. No West Virginia coal miner will ever again be able to say that George W. Bush is one of them. And that was the phrase that you heard all the time in this election. George W. Bush is one of us. But John Kerry, you know, some distant Boston Brahmin. We have to complicate their populism. We have to shatter their narrative. Second of all, talking this way strikes directly at the weakest point in the Republican coalition. Now, today's GOP is like yesterday's Democrats. It's a huge party made up of two large groups that are kept together by their, you know, shared hatred of liberals and government. But these two halves of their coalition are, on the one hand, you know, your traditional business Republicans, the ruling class of this country, and then on the other hand, your values voters who supply the base and the massive voter turnout. Economically speaking, these two groups have almost nothing in common at all. On workplace issues, on social insurance issues, and on minimum wage issues, their interests are diametrically opposed. The number one hallucination, I mean, the contradiction, we'll get to hallucination in a second. The number one contradiction in their coalition, though, is this idea encouraged by the Karl Roves of this world that the culture we live in is somehow controlled by these all-powerful liberals who sit behind the scenes and pull the strings and make the puppets dance. If you bring market forces back into the debate, you strip this away instantly. It's Rupert Murdoch, and it's Viacom, and it's Madison Avenue that make our culture what it is. Not free-floating liberal moral depravity. It's the market that is the greatest disrespecter of tradition and smasher of family values. Not Democrats. It's the market, you know, that melts everything that is solid into air. Now, third of all, in a demographic sense, economic populism or economic liberalism, or whatever you want to call it, gives the working class voters that have deserted the Democrats in such great numbers over the years, it gives them a reason to come back. They do studies of these voters all the time. And they're forever finding that these people, yes, they are conservative on cultural issues, but guess what? They're liberal on economic issues. Economic liberalism is the only comparative advantage that the Democratic Party has with these people. Even a substantial number of evangelicals can be reached with this kind of appeal. I mean, after all, Christianity is not the religion of devil take the hindmost and them what has gets, you know? I missed that part in the Sermon on the Mount. I've always thought that the alliance between evangelicals and the free market right is so, you know, unnatural and so much more tenuous than anybody suspects. And economic populism is basically the only way that you're going to be able to shatter that alliance and bring those people back into the Democratic Party. It's the only advantage we have with those voters, and it's the reason that those voters or their parents voted Democratic back in the day. You think of a guy like William Jennings Bryan, who was the standard bearer for American fundamentalism in the first half of the 20th century, and as liberal as they come on just about every issue except for evolution, as we all know, much to that poor man's, you know, lasting infamy. Anyhow, fourth of all, this talking this way, this kind of politics has the power to energize the Democratic base and even to expand it. And that's the critical factor. And this cannot be said of the politics of the mushy center. Now, one of the primary lessons that Democrats should have learned from the debacle of 2004, as my friend Rick Perlstein put it, Rick is one of the great political writers of my generation. He writes for the Village Voice these days, but he wrote a great biography of Goldwater, which everybody should read, because it's like how we were beat, you know, starting in 1964. But as he put it, coming out of this election, one thing we should have learned is that swing voters don't like swing candidates. You have to have a fighting faith, you know, and today's Democrats just don't have one. You've got to set out to convert people, to organize, and to build, just like the Republicans have done over the years. You can't just play the field as you find it and try to tailor a message that maybe someday 51% of people will eventually buy, hopefully. And finally, we have to talk this way because economic security and fighting for the little guy is who we are. These are our values, and they are powerful ones. Standing up against exploitation, against a life of misery, all done for the greater glory of the NASDAQ, this is deeply humane, deeply resonant stuff. And it also happens to be right. Thank you very much.
Author Thomas Frank, speaking earlier this month in St. Paul at the annual meeting of the Jobs Now Coalition. Frank is the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. Jobs Now, of course, is involved in advocating for an increase in Minnesota's minimum wage, among other things, gave Frank its annual Working Class Hero Award. Well, that does it for our midday program today. Gary Eichten here. Thanks for tuning in. We will be rebroadcasting Thomas Frank's speech at 9 o'clock tonight, rebroadcast at 9 here on Minnesota Public Radio, and then tomorrow, over the noon hour, quite a different worldview. We're going to hear from former Republican Congressman Bob Barr. That's tomorrow on Midday. Thanks for tuning in today.